Support for IPR and this podcast comes from the IMT Des Moines Marathon, October 19th and 20th, with 6 race events including the full and half marathons, marathon relay, 5K, and more. Register at DesMoinesMarathon.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Think back to the year 2011. In that year, the death of Apple co-founder Steve Jobs. What a visionary figure. How he changed the world, and how his death in that year brought a wave of doubt over the future of Apple. Well, now fast forward from that year and the death of Steve Jobs in 2011 to 2018. Apple becomes the world's first trillion-dollar public company. How did that happen without Steve Jobs at the helm? Well, my guest this hour, Leander Caney, has written a biography of the man who replaced Steve Jobs as chief executive in 2011. Tim Cook, the genius who took Apple to the next level, is the title of the book. Leander Caney, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me, Ben.
You are the author of several other books, including Inside Steve's Brain, Joni Ive, and Cult of Mac. You've covered Apple for more than 2 decades, and you are now the editor and publisher of cultofmac.com, former news editor of wired.com, just to mention that. So take us back, as you do in your book, to Steve Jobs' decision at the end of his life to hand over the reins of Apple to his COO, Tim Cook.
Yeah, it's Steve had been sick with cancer, pancreatic cancer, and had wanted to step down into to take more of a chairman role. He wanted to be the chairman of the board when he handed over the reins to Tim Cook. But, of course, he died about a month later. They both said publicly that they thought that he was going to survive a lot longer. And like you said, you know, at the time it was very dramatic, and a lot of people were very skeptical that Apple would do well under without Steve Jobs around. All of the pundits predicted, you know, spectacular disaster, and it must have been very intimidating for Tim Cook to step into the shoes of, you know, perhaps the most iconic leaders in business in American business.
Right, and this was, and the people who had the dire predictions looked at Tim Cook because they saw him as an odd counterpart to Steve Jobs. Why was he seen by some as an odd choice?
He was seen as the sort of the boring operations drone, more of a bureaucrat. Somebody made the trains run on time, but didn't have the product vision that Steve Jobs had. And of course, that latter part is, you know, we'll see how that works out. You know, Steve Jobs was, you know, perhaps the most visionary leader in tech. Had an amazing career, an amazing run of hits. You know, everything from the Mac to the iPod and the iPhone and the iPad. I mean, who has had a career like that? You know, introducing so many revolutionary products. So he has a very tough act to follow. But I think it's kind of a little bit unfair and a bit early yet to judge Tim Cook's tenure at Apple along those lines. You know, I think people forget that there was often decades between Jobs' big major products, and that Apple was, you know, most of the time making smaller incremental improvements. And also that a lot of the products that Apple introduced actually weren't hits straight out of the gate. You know, almost none of them were. Mm-hmm. You know, even the iPhone took 2 or 3 years to take off. The iPod took 2 or 3 years to take off. The Mac was such a disaster when it first introduced it almost completely sunk the company. And here in the Tim Cook era, you know, we've had the first major product was the Apple Watch. That was the first product that Steve Jobs didn't have any hand in. And it's looking like it's, you know, a smash hit. It's really bigger than the entire Swiss watch industry put together. It's the world's most popular wearable, and it's the first device that's been medically certified. And it's starting to save people's lives. You know, there's been reports of people discovering they had heart defects they didn't know about. And as Apple adds more health features to the watch, I think it could become a very big device indeed.
Mm-hmm. You recount in your book, you summarize what Apple represents in the world today. Tell us a little bit about some of the highlights that it's achieved in technology and financially, how dominant it is in this sector in some ways.
Yeah, Apple has become, you know, the big 800-pound gorilla. It tends to lead the tech industry. You know, I think a lot of other companies they blatantly copy what it does. If you look at a lot of the features in the iPhone and you look at its competitors, even the design, you know, is almost exactly the same. I mean, some of the Android handset makers were adding fake notches to make their phones look more like Apple's latest iPhones, the iPhone XS. And financially, it is so powerful that it can do a lot of, it can do almost anything at once. It's spending billions of dollars on transforming the way its carbon footprint, for example. So it's invested billions in solar and wind power. And this has had a big effect. Some of the other tech companies are also going green. Apple, of course, is the first company to be 100% green. But their demand for green power is so big that even utilities and, traditionally dirty utilities like, say, Duke Energy in the East Coast, because the demand is there for green power, this is one of the big reasons that wind and solar is now cheaper than coal.
Mm-hmm. And you point out in your book that when Tim Cook took Apple, became CEO, Apple was one of the least green companies in 2011, right?
Right. Greenpeace gave it a failing grade. Like you said, it was one of the least green companies in Silicon Valley. And one of the values that Tim has been pushing at Apple is to make Apple much more environmentally friendly. And they've really turned it around. They're now one of the most green companies in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And more importantly, they're bringing along their supply chain in China. They're investing billions of dollars there to try and make their supply chain, which is actually the majority of their carbon footprint, green as well. And they predict that they might be able to do it in 8 or 10 years. And manufacturing is one of the biggest and dirtiest, industries in the world. If Apple's able to convert its supply chain into 100% renewable, then a lot of the other manufacturing industry could too.
I wonder if you know whether Apple making that decision to become very green and 100% renewable energy, using that, what kind of ripples that creates in the economy across the world, across the country, compared to, say, government regulation saying,
right?
Do you have a comparison there?
Oh yeah, well, like I said earlier, Tim Cook, I saw him talk at a conference, and he said that when the government pulls back from the climate change and denies climate change, then it's up to the private sector. And he hired Lisa Jackson, who was the former head of the EPA in the Obama administration, to head up Apple's environmental efforts. This was in 2013. And he told her job description was to leave the world a better place than we found it, and that she could use Apple's resources to try to make a big difference in this area. And so, like I said, Apple's not alone. Companies like Facebook and Google are also investing massively in green power. Because of these massive data centers, the data centers they run draw as much electricity as small cities.
Mm-hmm.
So these are really big, big customers of the utilities, and they won't buy dirty power from the utilities. They don't want coal power.
Right.
They don't want polluting power. So, like I said, this ripple effect is going to the utilities. Now the utilities are also investing billions of dollars into wind and solar. And so it's having a big effect, and the effect is the fact that wind and solar is now cheaper than coal.
Right, and you're speaking to Iowans today. Iowans know well that we're a leader in wind energy, and we have several of these data centers drawing on green energy here in Iowa. If you've just joined us, my guest is Leander Caney. His book, Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level. He's a technology writer and author. Let's talk a little bit about Tim Cook's, his leadership style as rooted in his childhood. Take us back to his growing up gay in America's South. He grew up in Alabama. Was it Mobile? How this shaped his values?
Right. He was born in Mobile, but he grew up in a small town called Robertsdale, which is in the southern part of the state. And I think being gay had a big effect on his outlook. He had to keep that private. It wasn't something he could be open about at that time. He's bought an affection for privacy, he sees the importance of privacy at Apple. And he's one of the big leading proponents in Silicon Valley for comprehensive privacy laws. And he's completely at odds with their rival companies, Facebook and Google specifically. Their business model depends upon mining their customers' data. So he's one of the few people that's calling for legislation to protect customers' data, to have customers have more control over their data, and to impose fines and penalties if companies leak data. And, we see every week there's a huge data breach. And companies like Facebook are embroiled in big scandals with misinformation and fake news, and it's being linked to genocides in overseas. This is the kind of thing that Apple under Tim Cook wants to protect against. It wants to have strong privacy protections. And I think that comes, from his upbringing in Alabama.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about, when you talk about privacy and security, tell us about the standoff that Apple had under Tim Cook with the FBI after the terrorist attack we remember in San Bernardino, California.
Right, absolutely, yeah. And this is a big deal for Apple and for Tim Cook. They felt internally that this was risking Apple's public image, and it was betting the company by taking a stance against the FBI to protect the security of the iPhone. The FBI wanted Apple to create a special version of the iPhone software that would allow a backdoor, allow them to get into the phone and see if there was any evidence in there that was pertinent to the investigation. But Cook took a principled stand against this. He said that it was very risky for them to do that. This could leak, it could get out, and then it would compromise everyone's iPhones and everyone's iPad, and that they refused to do it. And, of course, they were immediately accused of sympathizing and abetting terrorists. And at the time, it was during the 2006 presidential election, and President Trump was then a candidate. He's immediately accused Apple of abetting terrorists, and he called for a boycott of the company. So there was a huge PR storm for 6 weeks. But I think Cook did a very good job of laying out the case for Apple and the case that that these devices need to be secure. Because we do everything on our devices these days. We shop, we bank, we communicate, with our loved ones. It's important that they are, trustworthy, they're secure. Mm-hmm. So he kind of bet the company by taking that stand, and eventually I think turned out to be successful.
Right, and as you point out in your book, you quote Tim Cook making it understandable for every person when he said, "If you put a key under the mat for the cops, the burglar can find it too." So how did Tim Cook solve that dilemma? Balance those two things.
Well, he refused to comply with the order, and he wanted it to go to court because he wanted to have a court rule on this, legally. He wanted to set a legal precedent. But the FBI, apparently they hired some hackers and who hacked into the phone and found there was no evidence. And once they'd done that, they didn't have a legal means to compel Apple to create their own to create this version of the operating system. So they had to drop the case. Legally, they had to drop the case, so it never went to court. And Tim Cook was actually disappointed about that because he wanted to have some kind of precedent.
Mm. If you just joined us, Leander Caney is my guest. He's written a biography of the man who replaced Steve Jobs as chief executive of Apple in 2011, shortly before Steve Jobs' death. The title of the book, Tim Cook, the genius who took Apple to the next level. I wonder if you can tell us about Tim Cook joining Apple, because as you write, quoting from your book, when Cook joined Apple on March 11th of 1998, it was not a place where many people wanted to work. The company was near bankruptcy and employee morale was low. So why did Cook leave, I think it was Compaq at that time, to join Apple?
That's right. Yes. Well, this is the magnetic charisma of Steve Jobs. He persuaded Tim Cook within about 5 minutes that he should quit his job at Compaq, which was then the most dominant company in the computing industry, to join Apple, which, like you said, was just a few weeks, a couple of months from bankruptcy. They were able to sort of see on the same level. Apparently, their first meeting, Jobs charmed him and persuaded him that he was together and with the other people that he'd hired, that they would be able to turn the company around.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk in the last few minutes about what we should be on the lookout in terms of revolutionary new products from Apple. As I mentioned at the outset, you've covered Apple for more than two decades. You have this cultofmac.com website, which, well, it is all things Mac. Apple. It's an Apple fan blog, right?
Right, exactly. Yep. We do news and how-tos and reviews.
Okay. So what should we be on the lookout in terms? Will we see the revolutionary new products continue to come from Apple?
Yeah, there are rumors that Apple's working on an autonomous car, and also, they're looking at healthcare. And this is interesting because, two of the world's biggest industries are transportation and healthcare. And in the transportation realm, if you have an autonomous car, That could be a really, really big, societal changing product. It would change everything, not just transportation, but, real estate and urban planning and even retail. That could be a hugely transformative product. And they're rumored to be working on this. And, of course, they have a lot of competition. There's a lot of other companies, including all the big car companies and companies like Uber that are also looking at this space. And the other thing is healthcare. They've already set up a lot of the infrastructure for digital health. And if you look at something like the Apple Watch, it's the first medically approved wearable device, and it can tell you about your heart health. It's already, saved some lives. There's already reports that people have found out they had a heart condition they didn't know about. And Apple's going to be adding more and more health features and wellness features. And if they're successful in doing that, I think this is the Apple Watch is the first product that Tim Cook has introduced that had no input whatsoever from Steve Jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're successful in adding more of these features, you can imagine that it could be a very big deal, because if this is a product that could save your life, I think a lot of people would be interested in wearing it.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, even though you're obviously a huge fan of Apple, do you have criticisms of some of the Apple products? I want to have full disclosure here, Leander, too. I used to be an Apple guy. I've been an Android guy, let's say, for several years with my cell phone. I like the expandable memory. I like the camera features better on the Android. How do you see that duel between Apple and Android in the coming years?
Well, you asked me about criticisms, and I was going to say, the Apple's devices are very expensive.
Yes.
And no one likes that. And I think tax dodging as well, a big black mark against Tim Cook is that, for all of his professed progressive values, they've done some, stuff that I think you could, people have been criticizing them for, which is, dodging taxes, having this huge cash hoard overseas, and not paying their fair share of taxes, and also things like share buybacks. When the Trump administration changed the tax laws and allowed them to repatriate a lot of that money, all of that money went into share buybacks, which benefits shareholders, people who already and shareholders. I think most shares are held by 10% of the country or something like that, the population. As for the competition with Android, it's Android phones are a lot cheaper, and the hardware is really beautiful. But I think they have a lot of problems with the software. If you look at things like on the App Store, Apple hasn't had one, I think they've had one case of an aberrant app that was uploading data to some servers without the customer's permission. So the App Store is, very secure. If you download something from Apple's App Store, Apple has looked at that app. It has vetted it. It's not, you won't get a virus. There's no malware.
Right.
It won't spy on you. And you don't have that kind of guarantee on Android.
Right.
You're kind of a little bit, you have to take responsibility for what you're downloading.
Right.
And there's a lot of viruses and a lot of malware on that platform.
Yeah, and I've heard Android described as like being a giant vacuum just sucking up your data. Would you agree
yeah,
with
me? That's not good, is it?
No, that's not a good selling point, is it? So you think in this duel between Apple and Android in the coming years, back to that point, will one dominate, or will we continue to have these sort of two worlds?
It's healthy, I think, to have these companies competing against each other. And the funny thing is that, Apple sells smaller numbers of phones than Samsung does. Samsung is by far the market share leader in terms of units. They sell vastly more Android phones than they do iPhones, than Apple sells iPhones. But Apple's making all the profits. They went after the high end of the market, and that's where the money is. So Apple's able to make, 20, 30% profits on its phones, whereas Samsung's really, struggling to make anything like that on its phones. And, of course, it makes it up in volume. But I'm glad to see it. They both push each other. People will accuse me of being a fanboy, I think Samsung tends to copy a lot of what Apple does, and tends to copy it not very well. And a good example is, their facial recognition system. Apple has what they call Face ID, which allows your face to act as your password. And Apple's system is really robust. It uses infrared to make a 3D map of your face. And Samsung came out with a similar system, a competing system, but it can be fooled by a simple picture. So you can hold up a picture of someone's face and it'll open the phone. So their system isn't, you know, is nowhere near as secure as robust as Apple's is.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at their latest phones, you know, there's reports today about the folding phone, which a lot of people said, oh, you know, why isn't Apple doing a folding phone? This is huge innovation. But a lot of reports say that the phones are breaking, the screens are breaking on the first day. So it's looking like a big disaster, you know, like their battery, with the exploding batteries that they suffered a couple of years ago. This is looking like another one. Samsung tends to, like, you know, they use the public as a sort of like a beta test. They put out a lot of stuff, and it looks inventive, but it often doesn't work that well. Apple tends to do this stuff in-house and do it secretly, and when they have something that works well, then they put it out into the market.
Leander, in closing here, you have spent so much time dealing with high technology, specifically Apple and Mac, and this is moving so quickly. You've covered in this book Tim Cook's reign at Apple, starting in 2011 to 2018. If we go 5 or 10 years into the future, is there any way, can you help us see what's out there in terms of technology when it's moving this quickly and changing our lives so quickly?
Yeah, it's difficult to do. I don't think, have much of a crystal ball, but we've talked earlier about autonomous cars and about healthcare. Tech is already, it's America's, you know, one of America's leading industries. It's taking over from the old industries like car making and steel making. It's all in software now. So it's going to become ever more important. And if you look at things like AI technologies, you know, it's already infecting a lot of software. Is AI driven, and I think it's going to become only more important. It could be quite scary in the future, you know, because there's going to be a lot of change from technology. AI could, technology already affected a lot of blue collar jobs, you know, with robots and manufacturing and offshoring, and AI could affect a lot of white collar jobs. You know, you can have AIs doing all kinds of like accounting and law practices and running, you know, if you call a call center, you talk to a robot, you don't talk to a human being any longer. That could have a massive impact on society.
In the next 5, 10, 15 years.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Wow, okay.
But we've seen, you know, technology has come along before and has made big changes, and I think people tend to adapt. You know, one of the things about software is that there's a lot more people making their living writing software than now these days.
Yeah.
And maybe when AI comes along, there will be a lot of new AI jobs that we can't imagine right now.
Okay, very good. A glimpse into the future from Leander Caney, his latest book, Tim Cook, The Genius Who Took Apple to the Next Level. Leander, thank you so much for spending time with us.
You're welcome, Ben. Thank you very much for having me.
When we come back, we'll find out about the Center for Statistics and Applications in Forensic Evidence. CSAFE is the acronym it goes by. It's based at Iowa State University in Ames. It's been around since 2015. We'll find out how they're working with the Innocence Project, that nonprofit legal organization that works to prevent and overturn wrongful convictions. That's when we come back. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.